Yep. I'm way more comfortable just twisted all the way in.
It's that big Neanderthal forehead you have.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This is episode 103, and our guest is Colby Croft from Swarovski Optic. In this conversation with Colby, we dive deep into optics for hunting, both binoculars and spotting scopes. We dissect them, we understand what they're made of, how they work, and why that matters for you as a hunter. We get into specifications so you know what you're looking at when you're shopping for optics, and it's really just an informational episode. But it's not all specs and geek talk. We also talk about how to best use optics, when you might choose a binocular over a spotting scope, when you're choosing a spotting scope, if you should go straight or an angled eyepiece. We get into a ton in this conversation. It's an hour that you're sure to enjoy and learn from, no doubt. Before we get into the show, I want to remind you guys about our big giveaway for episode 100. As this show is being released, you have just hours to enter, so if you're not in already, I hope you act fast. We're giving away an Exo Mountain Gear pack and more than a dozen other prizes from many of our friends and companies that we work with. Go to exomountaingear.com/100 and make sure you get entered soon, because this is ending on November 30th. Winners will be announced on December 1st, so if you're already entered, make sure you start checking your inboxes shortly thereafter. We'll be emailing all the winners. Okay, let's get into this episode with Colby Croft from Swarovski Optic. Colby, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. It's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, man. We were just joking a bit. You're in a Hampton Inn. We were saying that you're in the Hamptons currently.
That's right. That's right. Living life.
Yeah. But you're on the road quite a bit working with Swarovski. So that's a good place to start. We'd just love to kind of get your background, your position with Swarovski, your hunting background, anything relevant that you want to share just to help the listeners have some context and get to know you a bit. That'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So my position with Swarovski, I've been with them for 6 years, or nearly 6 years. I'm the Intermountain Territory rep for them, and I cover most of Utah, all of southern Idaho, western Montana, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and a little part of northern BC. So I have a really big territory, and I think it's the prettiest part of the whole country. I get to cover the Canadian Rockies and the Intermountain West in the U.S. and I love it.
Man, it's great. That's a freaking gorgeous part of the country to be running around all the time.
That's how I picked it. I just said, give me all the pretty parts, and that's how we ended up. So as far as my personal background goes, I'm a Utah native. Utah resident now, but I've had the opportunity to live and hunt in most of the western states over the years. I started big game hunting and small game hunting as soon as I could, like most rural Utah teens. And I've really spent quite a bit of time in the field, and it's really how I spend most of my spare time. So I've lived and hunted in, like I say, most of the western states. So I'm not just an optics geek or a technician. I'm not. I'm a hunter that happens to work for an optics company.
So. Yeah, that's a perfect. I mean, in talking with Steve, I know, you know, that he knows you from dealing with Swarovski in the past with S&S and being a dealer and things like that. But he's super excited to get you on. I'm super excited to meet you and have this conversation. And as you said, not only get more technical as someone who knows a product really well, but also have the advantage of someone who can bring that technical expertise, but then have experience in the field with it. That's like the perfect combination.
Well, I don't know how perfect it is, but we'll give it a whirl.
I was just thinking, man, too, not only like, do you get to travel all those amazing states? And I was thinking, man, you get to see some cool country with cool animals. But not only do you do that, but you do that with some awesome glass to accompany you. I'm sure you can get a lot of scouting done.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said I hadn't used my position to scope out some new areas and make some contacts and increase my hunting knowledge base and my opportunities for sure.
Yeah. Do a little field testing, you know, it's all part of the job.
That's right. It's all part of the job. It's all work.
yeah, for sure. Cool. So, let's kind of get the ball rolling. You know, there's so many aspects I think that we want to hit. The main goal tonight is really just to help our listeners, you know, understand optics better. You know, I'm sure that many of our listeners have different understandings of optics and a different technical understanding of optics, but you know, I do want to get into different specifications and helping us understand those, you know, things like objective and exit pupil and field of view and all that, but we can get into that. I would love just to start with, where is the place that you start, whether you are assessing an optic need for a hunt or you're just talking with somebody as you're out hitting a dealer and maybe talking to a hunter who's hanging in a shop. Like, what are some of the questions you ask someone to help guide them in optic selection, and or what are some of the things that you look at when you are selecting an optic for yourself? Like, where do you even start?
Sure, that's a great question. You know, one of the first things I do, especially if my intent is to recommend something to somebody, is I ask them what they're currently using and why they're either not happy with it or what they're looking to get out of changing to something else. I also like to know, I like to ask them about what type of terrain they're hunting in, or maybe what species, or even their method of hunting. You know, if you're the type of hunter that uses your feet to cover a lot of ground and spots game with your eyeballs and then tries to verify that with your optics, you may need something different than if you're the kind of hunter that climbs to a high point and sits on their hind end and glasses for hours on end. So those are two really different hunting styles, and they require completely different optics. So I like to start there and find out how they like to hunt, what they're using now, and then use that as a jumping off point.
Excellent. Yeah, good. I'm curious too, you know, and under, I guess, the big umbrella of optics, we can take it two different directions for hunting, and one would be talking about binoculars and the other be talking about spotting scopes, of course. And I'm sure that you use both in the field and they both have their place. I'm kind of curious if there's a gray area for you or where you sort of make that decision to go with one over the other. I mean, as you kind of mentioned, if you're, you know, say you're hunting thicker terrain, you're on the move, you're going more spot and stalk, you might just want some binos to glass, you know, a near field or kind of, you know, get a closer look versus a totally different style of hunting when clearly you're going to want a spotter if you're, you know, at a high open ridge and you're really going to put in some time. But between like those two extremes, I'm just kind of curious where you make a deciding point between one or the other, maybe depending on the situation, depending on the weather, depending on terrain, things like that.
Yeah, it's totally situational. I mean, if it's a mountain hunt where I'm carrying everything I have on my back, I might actually even forego a spotting scope or make a different binocular decision. So terrain has a lot to do with it, the style of hunt. But I generally go from a binocular to a spotting scope when I've already spotted game or I'm trying to get a better look at something that I've already glassed up with my binoculars. If I have the luxury of taking both, then I will I'll use my binoculars to cover ground to locate likely areas or find a, you know, an ear flick or an antler tine, and then I'll use the spotting scope to get a little bit closer look. But, you know, generally distances that I'm using my spotting scope in a hunting scenario, generally over, you know, 1,000 yards and out is where my spotting scope really starts to come into play. I feel like with a good high power binocular, I can cover ground pretty good you know, 1,000 yards and in, but I hunt with people who will actually use a spotting scope to glass and to pick the country apart. I don't find that's very comfortable for me, but I think it's up to the individual person. Some people are fine with that, keeping one eye in that spotting scope for hours on end and picking the country apart. So I think it's up to the individual, but that's how I do it. I'll generally, for close in, you know, 100 to 300, 400 yards, I'll use the binocular that hangs around my neck either a 10 power or an 8 power, tripod mounted or handheld, and then I'll go to a 15 power or a 12 power binocular for that 500 to 1,000 yard distance, and then switch to a spotter if I find something that I need to take a closer look at. That's how I do it.
What's your, it's always the debate of 8 or 10X. What's your go-to for a Western hunt?
I'm a weird dude. I like the 8 power. I have reasons for that. I like the wide field of view of an 8 power. I feel like I can hold an 8 power steadier. You hold them the same, a 10 power and 8 power, but the 10 power magnifies your hand tremor a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I feel like I don't miss out on anything carrying an 8 power. An 8 power is always going to be brighter given the same objective lens diameter. So I feel like I've got a little bit better low light performance with an 8. But by and large, most people pick the 10 power, and it's a little bit of a trade-off, but one that most people are kind of willing to live with, a little more magnification, a little less light. But I'm an 8 power guy.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm the odd man out.
Yeah, but I actually think most guys would be better off with 8 power, you know, especially if you're not tripod mounting. Right. I think just hand holding it and walking through the elk woods, you're going to be better off with that 8. Like I said, we did a lot of tests on it, and the difference in that apparent shake is pretty substantial.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll tell you what, you get an 8 power binocular on a tripod, get it stabilized, and it's amazing what you can see. You don't really give up much by not having that high magnification. You've got, you know, really good wide field of view, and it's easy on your eyes, and you can pick country apart pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of that, I don't know if it's just me noticing, but I'd kind of love to hear feedback, as it seems like I'm seeing more and more guys go with a 12 or a 15, and obviously, hopefully, tripod mounted in that case, but are you seeing an increase in guys going with a higher power binocular, such as the 15s?
Yeah, absolutely, and we've seen a shift to that over the last several years. Our 15 has really been more and more popular. And I think most guys aren't using, or most hunters aren't using, that 15 power as their primary binocular. But I do see a lot of people using a 12 power as their primary binocular. And if you can stabilize it, you know, sitting down and tucking your elbows in and maybe grabbing the brim of your hat with your binocular and get it really steady, then I think a 12 power might be something that you could handhold, but I the way I use them and the way I hunt, I'm not sure I would give up that low magnification and just carry a 15. But yeah, they're more and more popular, and I think every manufacturer now has come out in the last few years with a 15 by 56 of some sort. So I think the market really for that high power binocular is better than it's ever been.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I could see, like, you know, guys chasing coos deer down in the south or something, you know, really liking that 15 setup.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've done quite a bit of that, and it's perfect for that. But hunting coos deer in southern Arizona has kind of opened my eyes, so to speak, no pun intended, to using those 15s like on a high country mule deer hunts, or even elk hunting. You just feel like you own, 1,500 yards in every direction. Nothing escapes your eye. It's really a pretty impressive hunting tool. And I think that's kind of what's happening, is people are seeing that, using that a little bit more and seeing the benefit. Mm. For sure.
Well, what do your 1556s weigh?
That is a very good question. I don't have the weight in front of me.
Okay.
They're heavy. They're not light by any means. They don't weigh twice as much as a 10 by 42, but they weigh, 50% more at least. So big, huge prisms and big, heavy pieces of glass. And they are a little, I wouldn't want to carry them around my neck. You know, they usually are in my pack when I've got them. But, if I had to off the cuff guess, I would call it maybe 36 ounces.
Okay. Speaking of the prisms, is that,
yes.
So when we were at the Northwest Mountain Challenge, Colby was up there, and a pair of binos was basically cut in half, and that was the prisms, those giant chunks of glass, right?
Right.
Yeah. We'll have to put a picture up on as like the podcast image for this, because it was absolutely blew my mind. I had never seen that image before. The thickness, I mean, that was like an inch and a half thick of glass in there.
Yeah, really? It's a big chunk of glass. Yeah, and I think the thought process there. Most people look at a binocular and they think, you know, you've got two pieces of glass with a couple of things in between. But, you know, as you saw on that cutaway, there's 10, maybe 10 lenses in there and two prisms. So there's glass from one end to the other. And that prism, yeah, is a big piece of heavy, dense glass.
You look at that and I can't even imagine that an image gets transferred through it. It was absolutely crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting light path, and pretty complicated. And you know, it's interesting. If you didn't have that prism in there, your binoculars would be the length of two rifle scopes side by side. So we use the prism to shorten the light path to make the overall optic shorter and more handy and more compact, but it does all kinds of crazy bad things to the image quality that you then have to fix after the prism. It requires a couple more things. You have to add back in that the prism kind of takes out, and so it's not maybe optically the best way to get a really good image, but it's used to shorten the light path, and make the optic handier, easier to carry.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so fascinating to hear. You kind of mentioned that there's maybe up to 10 lenses, in a binocular, for example. I mean, I was aware of obviously having the objective end and then the eyepiece, and then I knew that there was a prism involved in the middle, but I had no idea that there was essentially multiple layers, if you will, of glass in between. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch, like in a rifle scope, I think, got a cutaway rifle scope there as well. I think there's 16 lenses in a rifle scope. So there's a lot going on in between those two ends that you don't see.
Yeah. So it just kind of highlights the point that if we talk, you know, you hear guys talk about, oh, the quality of the glass. And so many times I think myself and probably most of us think of just that in the quality of the glass that we can see, you know, the front end and the back end, but there's clearly a lot of steps along the way. And if, you know, that's just more and more the importance of the quality, because you're just, you know, there's so many pieces there in between. They all have to be quality to get that quality picture through.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. They all have, all of the different lenses in there have kind of a different job. Like one is a focusing lens, and then there's a, you know, HD objective lenses that reduce color fringing, and they all do a little different job, and they all require a little different type of glass. If you start to put together that many pieces of glass and you do it poorly, the bad stuff just stacks up over that many lenses, and it's, you know, ends up being a lower quality image through that optic. So
yeah. That's great. Let's talk just a little bit about kind of the some of the keywords that we've already mentioned, some of the buzzwords, but just so all the listeners are kind of clear as they hear the show or get to shopping, things like that. So we talk about like the objective, that is essentially the non-eyepiece side, the far side of an optic, whether that's binoculars or spotting scope. And that would be the right-hand number. When we're talking about like a 15 by 56, we're talking about like a 56 millimeter objective, right?
Correct. Yeah. The diameter of the objective is the second number in the, 56.
And then we get into spotting scopes, and then, you know, you might have a variable range on the front end, a number to a number, and then by the objective, such as 80 on the spotting scope or 65 or what have you.
Correct. And that, and those numbers tell you a couple of things. The first number is the magnification, how many times, it magnifies over and beyond your regular vision. So a 15 power binocular magnifies the image 15 times what you would see with your naked eye. So it's like being 15 times closer, right? The 56 is the objective size, and the relationship between those two numbers is what we call exit pupil. And that basically is the diameter of the shaft of light that comes out of the back of the binocular or the optic and goes into your eye to make an image. So you'll have, you know, two 8 power binoculars side by side, one maybe an 8 by 42 and the other is an 8 by 32. They have the same effective magnification, but the amount of light that comes through, or the diameter of the shaft of light that comes through the eyepiece of the 8x42 is bigger than the 8x32. So you're going to be able to make a better image under lower light conditions with a bigger objective lens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yep, so the higher the exit pupil, essentially the more light's getting to your eye.
Correct. Yep, an exit pupil is objective lens divided by magnification.
Okay.
Perfect. Isn't there like the it's during certain lighting conditions the actual pupil of the human eye can be smaller than the light coming through?
Yeah, for sure. And that's what you kind of want to do. That's why an 8x42, that's why I like an 8x42, because that's kind of the optical ideal, right? The human pupil, human eye, the pupil will dilate up to like 6 millimeters or down to, I think it's 1.5 millimeters or so when it's stopped all the way down under bright conditions. Uh-huh. And you want to match that exit pupil of your optic as best you can to the diameter of your pupil. So an 8x42, that is what, six millimeter? Six times eight.
48.
Right?
Really close. We'll get there. It's close enough.
That's close enough. So just under 6 millimeters, and that's about what your eye would dilate up to, your pupil would dilate up to under low light conditions, right? So you want those two to match as best you can. So if you, in low light conditions, if you're using like an 8x25 pocket with, you know, half the size of an exit pupil of like an 8x50, let's say, you're going to get half of the light coming through there. It's kind of starving your eyeball of light. Yeah. And it's harder to make a good image with, especially even like as your eyes get older, they're less, just like your hamstrings, they're less flexible, right? And so they might not even dilate up to six millimeters in diameter. So then a lower magnification, larger objective lens kind of becomes even more important. But there's trade-offs. You don't want to be carrying this gigantic, you know, binocular around with a 60 millimeter objective lens just to get more light. It's all trade-offs, right?
Mm. Yeah, I've always known that exit pupil being higher is good for low light transmission, but I've never directly correlated it to kind of understanding how the human eye works and dilates, and that's really good. That's good to know.
Yeah. And to Steve's point, Steve asked if it's possible for the exit pupil to be larger than your actual pupil. And yeah, in the middle of the day, if you look at somebody who's looking through a pair of binoculars midday and their pupil stopped way down, you can actually see a circle of light on their iris around their pupil that's just kind of bouncing off. It's not actually going into their eyeball because it's larger in diameter than their pupil is at that point.
Interesting.
So another piece to this puzzle, it would be field of view. You know, it's somewhat self-explanatory, but help us think through that, what it is, and then the repercussions of performance, because clearly there are some, especially when it comes to using an optic in a hunting scenario.
Yeah, for sure. Field of view is how wide the image is or how big the image is that you can see, usually expressed in either a degree of angle or a so many feet at 1,000 feet. Right. So, but all it's referring to is how big of a chunk of country you can see, by looking through that optic, right? How wide it is, or how, I'm not sure if that's a great explanation, but, let's try that again. Let's try field of view again. Ask me the question again.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of it in terms of, like you can see so much square footage of essentially through the picture, right?
Square footage is a great, that's a great way to look at it. Absolutely. Yeah.
So your field of view could be 10 square feet, or if you have a higher field of view, you could be seeing 15 square feet. You can just see more ground. And that's not necessarily to say that, that directly always coordinates with magnification, right? Like you could have, just throwing out made up numbers, you could have 10 magnification and see 10 square feet. Or you could have 10 magnification and see 15 square feet. The animal you're looking at is the same size, but you essentially have more context or more area that you're seeing around that animal, for example, right?
That's correct. And it is sometimes inversely proportional to magnification. So if you go up in magnification, you'll lose field of view. Generally speaking, there are some exceptions to that, but most of the time, if you increase magnification, you will lose some field of view. And having a nice wide field of view is another reason I like eight powers. I can see a big swath of country without having to move my optic around very much. Whereas if I'm looking through, like, say, a 60 power spotting scope, I'm seeing, you know, a tenth of that much country all at once. I'm seeing it closer, but it's a much smaller chunk of ground, and it's you know, it's harder to cover a lot of territory that way optically.
I found that field of view kind of makes it tough when you're analyzing or comparing binocular to binocular, because if you're looking through a 10x42 and, you know, one company and a 10x42 another, and have different field of views, the one with the narrow field of view has the perception of being more magnified, so the image can kind of look better. Yeah, I don't know if you ran into that yourself, Colby, but it kind of throws you off sometimes. Of like, if you're just in a store, I think it'd be a good thing to pay attention to. If you're looking at an elk mounted across Cabela's or something like that, you know, if it has a narrow field of view, it has the appearance of looking bigger, even though it isn't.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there are actually two things that are expressed. There's actual field of view and there's apparent field of view. And they're not exactly the same thing. So some optics will have an actual field of view saying this is how many feet at 1,000 feet or 1,000 yards you can see when you look through this optic. But the apparent field of view, that's the apparent field of view. But the actual field of view might maybe much smaller than that, because maybe the edges of the lens aren't really that usable and it's out of focus anyway. So like usable field of view and the actual field of view may be two different things.
I've never caught on to that before. They would actually rate like that if the outer 20% of the edge of the lens is blurry, they're not counting that in the actual field of view.
Generally it is counted. That's why you have to kind of be a little bit careful when you look at field of view specs. Is they're
interesting.
Everybody's going to advertise the best number, right? You can see 215 feet at this distance. Well, if only 200 feet of that is in focus, then the actual usable field of view is only 200 feet.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. Yep.
Another point, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think a lot of guys assume a larger objective equals a larger field of view, and I don't believe that's the case.
That is not the case. In fact, in our line, we have the widest field of view of any binocular that we have in our line is actually in an 8x32 or 8x32 VL. Yeah.
That's what I thought. Wide field of view. And why is that? I mean, do you know, just something in the design of the binocular construction?
It's all in the design of the eyepiece. All of the magnification is back in the eyepiece of the binocular. And that's what determines field of view, is how those lenses are set up. And what the engineer is actually trying to do with it, right? You can, and you also, one thing we haven't talked about yet, but it's also generally related to field of view is lost it.
You weren't going to say eye relief, were you?
I was going to say eye relief. Thank you very much.
Were you really?
Mark, I was going to say eye relief. You should answer the question.
I have a bullet point of like notes on like these specs that I wanted to hit, and it was quite literally the next thing I wanted to talk about. So I was just like hoping that's where we were going.
Absolutely. Yeah. So eye relief. Eye relief is the distance your eyeball has to be from that ocular lens, the eyepiece lens, to make a full field of view image. Right. It's usually expressed in millimeters, and it can be anywhere from 10 millimeters up to some, you know, a really long eye relief in a binocular is like 22 millimeters. But that is also generally inversely proportional to field of view. So a longer eye relief will generally result in a smaller field of view. Not always, but most of the time. A longer or a shorter eye relief will generally give you a larger field of view.
Interesting. One thing along those same lines is, you know, any high quality or any binocular these days is going to have a twist up eye cup. And I've noticed, I think a lot of people just assume naturally to twist them all the way out. And I just see, if you go to Cabela's and watch someone grab a pair, I think more often than not, they're going to twist them all the way out thinking that's where they need to be. But can you kind of talk about why the eye cups are, you know, adjustable in and out?
Absolutely. Yep. So like if somebody wears eyeglasses, and a binocular has like 21 millimeters of eye relief, that's long enough eye relief to run those eye cups all the way down to the bottom and push them right up against your glasses and look through your glasses into your binocular. And it's all about comfort. Like I use mine. I don't wear glasses, but I use my eye cups all the way in. But I've seen the same thing, Steve. I've seen people, the first thing they do is grab them and pull them all the way out. Well, some of our models specifically, that last stop on that eye cup is so far away from the lens that it's really, you know, you find yourself mashing them into your face to really get a good image quality. And I think somewhere in the middle, you know, between the lowest stop and that, they usually have several stops in there, and between all the way in and all the way out is usually where most people find them most comfortable. But I think that's, you know, it's habit to grab them and twist them all the way out.
I'm the same as you. For me, I always leave mine all the way twisted in. I don't know if it's the how deep my eye sits from kind of the front of my forehead or, you know, my nose, whatever it is. Yep. I'm way more comfortable just twisted all the way in.
It's that big Neanderthal forehead. I do the same thing. I twist my eye cups all the way in, and then I just push them against my eyebrows. And it does a couple of things. It puts it in the right spot for me. If I spend a lot of time in my glasses, I don't like to have a lot of pressure against my eye sockets. It gets to be painful after a while. But I like them all the way in also because it allows air to flow in between my face that may be warm from just having hiked, and my eyepiece lens on my binocular that may be cold because it's been hanging around my neck, you know, in the cold air. And with the eye cups all the way in, I find I get a lot less fogging and of that lens. And it's just more comfortable for me, but it's personal preference, you know.
Gotcha.
Everybody has a little difference.
Yeah.
And different face shapes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not all Neanderthals.
That's right. That's right. You know, another thing is interpupillary distance. I don't know if that's on your list of things to talk about.
But, it was not, but it sounds fascinating.
we abbreviate it as IPD, right? Interpupillary distance. And it's basically, you know, all binoculars specifically are hinged in the middle so that you can push them together or pull them apart to a certain point where it's going to match how far apart your eyes are. And that's a huge difference from person to person. In interpupillary distance, there's really no average. It's all across the board. And so I see a lot of people pick up optics and look through them without ever moving that interpupillary distance one way or the other. And it's impossible to get a full field of view if you don't have that interpupillary distance set to match your interpupillary distance.
So when you publish that, the IPD, I'm assuming that's a range then?
Correct. Yep. It's a range of distances. Yeah. Yep.
Right. Okay. Perfect. Yeah, I'm not like the expert on optics by any means, but I've looked at plenty and I don't recall seeing that as like, you know, one of the things that stands out to me on spec sheets. Do many companies publish that?
No, they sometimes do on some of the bigger binoculars like the 1556. Those big objective lenses will limit how close you can actually get the eyepieces, you know. So that's one of those things that like I couldn't use. There are several 1556s on the market that I can't use. They just don't go close enough together. I've got fairly narrow set eyes. So that's one thing people should at least try before they, you know, make a purchase decision, is to make sure that binocular can physically be made to fit their eyeballs.
One of the things we see, and I know we can kind of go down a giant rabbit hole on this one, but just to understand kind of the terms and then we can get deeper into it, is lens coatings. And, you know, you'll see coated and multi-coated and fully coated and kind of all these terms. Kind of help us understand what the differences are there at a high level.
Sure. Coated means that something somewhere in that optical system is coated with something, right? Multi-coated means that somewhere in that optical system, some lens or some prism has multiple layers of some type of coating on them. And then fully multi-coated means that every air-to-glass surface in that optical system is coated with multiple layers of coatings. And like some of our coatings are up to 29 layers thick and 29 layers of stuff, and it's, you know, a millionth of an inch thick, right? So, and all of those coatings do different stuff, but yeah, fully multi-coated anymore. Most every, even in lower price points, most every optic you're going to find is going to be fully multi-coated. Yeah. Used to not be that way, but
I was going to say, you'd probably have to get below like a $200 pair of binoculars to find something. Yeah.
Yep. And they still may be fully coated, meaning that every lens has some type of coating on it on every surface, but they may not have multiple lens coatings on every surface. So
yeah. So multiple coating could mean a few, or, you know, as you mentioned, some of your lines up to 29. Just give us an idea. Clearly, we can't run down all 29 coatings on an optic for you, but what are some of the purposes, some of the advantages, some of the functions of these coatings? You mentioned multiple purposes for sure, but just kind of a rundown of what some of those things might be.
Yeah, the most common coating type is like an anti-reflective coating. So when light hits the surface of glass, it'll either go through it unimpeded, right, be transferred through the glass, or it will reflect off. A certain part of it will reflect off, and a certain part of it will be changed as it goes through the lens. It will change its light path, and that is refracted, right? It'll be either reflected, refracted, or transmitted. An anti-reflective coating reduces that amount of light that is reflected off the glass surface. It makes most of the light go through the lens and not bounce off. So you think of that, an anti-reflective coating, you think you would look at a lens and it would, if it had an anti-reflective coating, you wouldn't be able to see any reflection of anything on the glass, but that's not how it works. It only deals with the light waves that are going through it. But that's the most common is an anti-reflective coating. And those are generally on every air to glass surface in a good optic. To keep stray light from bouncing around in there, you want as much light that goes into the objective to come out the ocular as you can get. So, and then there's coatings like exterior coatings, like most of the companies have them. We have one as well that are like an anti-stick coating. That will keep things from sticking to the lens, tree sap and dirt and mud and everything, kind of like Rain-X on your windshield. It doesn't let stuff stick, and they're generally hygroscopic, so water will bead up on the lens surface. Then there's exterior coatings that are hardened coatings to be more scratch proof, make the coatings below them more scratch proof, less prone to be scratched. So those are the three most common: an anti-reflective, some kind of hygroscopic or anti-stick coating, and then a kind of a durability layer over the top of that.
Yeah. So let's transition kind of away from some of the specifications and things that we see as we're looking at optics on the market, and you know, these numbers that we see in published materials, to really kind of assess as we pick up an optic. We begin to look through it. We begin to kind of compare one to another. Some of the things that we're looking at in terms of contrast and color, you know, transmission and low light, edge-to-edge clarity, you know, some of these more the visual experience of the optics. Is there a certain approach that companies take to that specifically intentionally? Because you'll hear that, you know, this one has higher contrast or lower contrast, or this one has, you know, more of a cool hue or a warm hue. I would just love to kind of hear from your perspective some thoughts on these visual characteristics.
Yeah, for sure. I think to start the answer to that question, I think you kind of have to remember that the human eye is a really kind of a poor measuring device. They're not very well calibrated, and everybody's are different. And then they're all kind of hardwired to a kind of subjective computer that may have, preconceived notions or brand biases or whatever. So looking through two optics side by side sometimes can be a little bit tough to discern a difference between the two because the human eye is not that sensitive of an instrument, right? But all of that stuff can be measured. And I think, most optics companies do measure those contrast and brightness and all of that. Some of it's a little bit subjective, and some people prefer a kind of a cool tone, and some people prefer a warmer tone, and that's kind of up to the end user. But what I do, I'll tell you what I do when I first pick up an optic to evaluate it. The worst place to do it is in a brightly lit retail store, right?
Yeah, that's with indoor lighting.
Where most people, yeah, exactly. Yeah. With big fluorescent lights that make everything look awesome. That's kind of the worst place to do it, but that's usually where people have the most exposure to multiple brands of optics or multiple price points of optics. So I'll generally point somebody toward like a dark corner, you know, where there's not good light and maybe something with a lot of detail at distance as far away in the store as you can see. That's going to start to show some differences in different optics. But the best place is, of course, outside. And the other thing you want is low light conditions that will start to really separate that image quality from one optic to another. I tend to look, like I say, at small objects at distance, how fine a detail you can see. Price tags in some of the big box stores is a good way to do that, because you know they're very detailed and they have small writing and everything on it, and everybody knows what the number six looks like. So if you can get something far enough away to really study it, that can be helpful. But yeah, like I say, hue and contrast and some of those things, color rendering, those can be a little subjective and they're a little harder to pin down. And some companies will try and skew their. There's one company out there that a while ago, I'm not sure if they still do, but they actually manipulated some of their coatings to make reds and browns kind of pop from a green background. And the idea there was, you know, animals, elk and deer, are red and brown in color and foliage is green in color. And if you can separate those colors out, that it will make animals kind of pop from the background, right? Great mm-hmm. idea. And makes total sense. But what it did, the end result was they kind of manipulated the blue spectrum of light to make that happen. And your eyeball sees blue light as brightness. And so it made that binocular appear not very bright, even though technically it may have had the same exact light transmission as everything else in its class. The eye kind of perceived it as a little darker. And that's where you get into trouble is your brain's kind of trying to Photoshop what you're looking at and working hard to do that and trying to make the image as good as it can so it can be super subjective, right?
Yeah, that's actually a great point, because I was going to ask about, are there trade-offs in terms of, you know, an optic that has great contrast might not have great color, or are there trade-offs between contrast and low light transmission? Is that just a matter of balancing a good profile overall versus choosing one strength that has a corresponding weakness?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's all trade-offs. And I think the hardest thing to do is to magnify an image and make it look like it looks unmagnified, right? That's really difficult to do. So manipulating the color and manipulating the amount of light that's coming through there is kind of the balancing act that everybody's trying to hit the sweet spot there and give your eye what it would be seeing if it was unmagnified. And that's difficult to do. And if you have an optic that has super high light transmission, but that light is not managed well, you're going to get an image that's all blown out and, you know, low contrast image. So it's kind of a balancing act for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. What about, we kind of mentioned this in terms of field of view and effective field of view, but evaluating edge-to-edge clarity between different optics. Clearly, we want the best use of all of our field of view and the best use of all glass. But what are some of the things specifically to look for there? Is that something, again, we have any tips on sort of analyzing that if guys are shopping around? Is that something where it's more subjective, or can we more objectively evaluate that?
No, that one's easy to evaluate objectively, and that's probably the easiest thing to evaluate in that same setting, because you can pick something with detail across the store or across the parking lot and focus it in the middle of the optic and then move it toward the edge, and you can kind of map that sweet spot in that objective or in that optical system. So you can, you know, move it around from top to bottom, left to right, that image or that item that you're looking at, and kind of make mental note of where it goes out of focus. And you can kind of map donut of fuzziness around the middle. It's difficult and expensive to make that go away, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the differences, one of the main differences between a lower quality optic and a higher quality optic is much more care and time is taken to make the edges of that lens work like the middle of that lens. So if you have this big, huge wide field of view and only 30% of it's in focus, it doesn't do you any good to have a big wide field of view. So, but mapping that sweet spot is really easy to do just by that. Price tags work great for that. At a price tag, move it around and just kind of make mental note. You can really start to see a difference from brand to brand and from optic to optic by doing that for sure. Mm.
Yeah. One thing I was just going to say that I think could be, if you're walking into a big box store or whatever, I would highly ask to see if they could throw them on a tripod. Cause that's really like when we're evaluating binoculars, like we just did at the Northwest Mountain Challenge, we had, Colby was up there and we had some other companies as well, and just got to put everything on a tripod cause your hand shake alone is going to make it really hard to decipher through that. So if Absolutely. I was walking into a store, I would ask them, hey, do you got a tripod and a tripod binocular mount? Cause I think you're going to immediately start seeing the difference between, you know, $400 binos and $2,000 binos.
Absolutely. The other thing too is if you can stack them on top of each other, if you're trying to evaluate one binocular with another, if you can stack them on top of each other, it's easier to go between them more quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Looking at the same object and just to put one down and pick it up, and then put the other one down and pick it up, and go back and forth. It's easier if you stack them on top of each other. There's all kinds of ways to evaluate. You can get online and you can find a whole bunch of the naturalist market tends to do a lot more of this, but they have like artificial star tests and all of these methods for evaluating one binocular versus another, and sometimes they'll put a three times tripler behind the lens, so they're looking at they're looking through a 10 power binocular but at 30 power. To really start to pull apart some of the differences. It's up to the individual buying the optic, what they like and what they like in the image. So, like I say, some people like a cooler image, some people like a warmer image. And that's why there's a bunch of different brands and a bunch of different price points, because something different works for everybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that subject of price points, and, you know, we've been talking about quality when we talked about edge to edge, but I'd just love to kind of hear some thoughts on price points. And clearly, you know, you can get optics all over the place in terms of budget, and clearly Swarovski's at the top end of that with quality products. But, you know, as you're talking with customers or folks in the store, you know, not everybody wants to commit that type of money to optics, which is fine. But for those guys who do, or maybe those guys who are thinking about taking a leap and making an upgrade in their optics and in quality, you know, what are really some of the main benefits that they're going to see stepping up in the quality game? And then anything you want to add just in terms of why do the prices vary so much? Like what goes into that different price point?
Sure. You know, one thing that I've noticed over the years, and prior to working for Swarovski, I worked for a big outdoor retailer. And so I've been on both sides of the counter for quite a long time selling optics. And one thing that kind of has become a universal truth, at least in my experience, is that most of the optics in a certain price point are going to be very, very similar in performance. So you really can't get something for nothing. So all of the binoculars in that $300 to $400 price point, those are all going to perform very similarly. And you almost have to double that price point to see an immediately discernible difference in quality. So, and you can kind of look at the price points that are out there and see that there's a lot of $300-ish, roof prism binoculars, and there's a lot of $500 to $600-ish, and then it goes up to $1,000, because in between those price points there's not that stark of a difference to immediately see it just by, you know, a cursory glance through them. So you almost, like I say, have to double the price point to see an appreciable difference, but what you get as you go up the scale is you generally get, of course, better quality glass. Glass is actually not that much of the final. It's not that expensive. What am I trying to say? The glass isn't the end all be all of what makes an optic expensive or not. You it's not that big of a part of the final price, like the raw material, right? The optical glass. So, but what is done with that glass can be a huge part of what the final price of that optic ends up being, because it's, like I said, it's expensive and difficult to grind those lenses to a certain tolerance, right? So as you go up the price scale, you'll start to find better materials. Like some of the lower end binoculars will have polymer housings and molded plastic housings, molded parts, sintered metal parts. And then as you go up the price scale, you'll start to see more aluminum housings with rubber over mold. And then, you know, you get up into the higher price points, you'll start to see some more exotic materials like magnesium and way more machined parts and fewer cast parts. So all of those things add up to a better overall image quality. If you can take the highest quality parts and machine them to the tightest tolerances and put those together with, you know, innovation and innovative design, and then assemble those parts in a very precise manner, using highly skilled labor, that's like the most expensive way to do it, but you're going to come out with an expensive and very high quality product, right? Mm-hmm. By contrast, if you're putting together medium quality parts at a medium level of precision, maybe with a lot of machine, a lot of assembly line type manufacturing and stuff, that's going to yield a less expensive product, but it's also going to yield a lower quality product, right?
Yeah.
So that's what you'll see. You'll see better ergonomics as you go up the price scale as well. That more thought is put into how it feels in your hand and how it looks and the aesthetics of it and of course image quality. It seems that image quality is always what people look at when they evaluate an optic. Mm-hmm. But the better the overall build quality, the longer it's going to last you, the better it's going to work over time. The better the experience is going to be. But, you know, everybody has their budget. And my advice is, I'm lucky enough to have become quite an optics snob. I get to play with a lot of really good stuff, right? but there's a lot of stuff out there that's really, really good. And you can't, like I say, you can't get something for nothing. I would, for an individual looking to purchase an optic, I would set, you know, a budget and say, this is the absolute most I'm willing to spend, and spend right up to that dollar amount, whatever your budget will bear, because there absolutely is a progression of quality, not only in the optical quality, but in the build quality as you go up that price scale.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned ergonomics, because that's one thing I feel gets overlooked. As you mentioned, most folks are just looking almost strictly at optical quality, and, you know, there's good reason for that. But when we talk about getting behind glass and really spending some time behind glass, ergonomics become absolutely critical.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's one binocular on the market that I really want to like. And I like the company that makes it, and I have friends that work there, and I really want to like it, but I can't even use it because the way the eyepieces are designed, they don't fit in my eye sockets. They're just too big. So that's one of those things that it may be a spectacular optic, but I'll never know because I can't physically look through it. It doesn't get close enough to my face, you know? So ergonomics and that ergonomic design, are part of the whole deal for sure.
Yeah.
Can you, just kind of going back to more technical spec stuff real quick, just to clarify, cause you know, I don't know if it's probably been 10 years now since like HD glass and ED glass came on the market. Mm-hmm. And obviously I think it's become more of a marketing term now. I mean, you'll see some guys like, oh, I got this $300 pair of binoculars that's got HD glass. And really, that, can you just elaborate on that further?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what's happened, Steve, is just that. And we stopped a few years ago putting the HD moniker on our optics because it kind of has lost its meaning. Mm-hmm. There's no standard out there for what HD means. So you can claim something's HD based on whatever standard you want to use. But what it typically meant and what it traditionally meant was an HD, an APO, an FL, those are all the same thing essentially. And what they typically mean is that there's a presence of some sort of apochromatic system in that optic that reduces color fringing. So APO stands for apochromatic. HD is just another way of saying the same thing. And it's usually, like I say, the presence of an apochromatic doublet, which is two lenses in the objective end of the optic, made of glass that is high in fluoride content. And it does a really good job of reducing color fringing, making all of the different colors of the light spectrum pass through that glass at kind of the same speed and hit the same focal point on the other end. Mm-hmm. So,
so is that directly related to chromatic aberration?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yep. Okay. That's exactly what it does is it reduces or in some cases can almost eliminate that chromatic aberration. Okay. Yep.
And color fringing. I read that the best way to test for that would to be look at look at a bird up in a tree with a bright blue sky behind it.
Absolutely. And, yep. High contrast. Yep. High contrast. Things like a skylined animal is a really good way to see it. You'll see a halo of in a optic that doesn't have good correction for chromatic aberration. You'll see a orange or purple halo around that object, and it's difficult to see. It's one of those things that your brain tries to make go away, tries to Photoshop that out of there. So you really have to look for it. Once you know how to see it, you can see it. And the presence of an HD in an optic is made specifically to make that go away. And there are HD optics out there on the market, or optics that are claimed to be HD on the market that have horrible chromatic distortion. And it doesn't mean what it used to mean, but it's right. a good high quality optic, especially a high magnification high quality optic, will have that fluorite objective lens doublet to reduce that for sure.
Okay.
And any reputable company any of the long-time, well-known companies in the industry, if they say something's HD, it's going to have that apochromatic lens system in it for sure.
Okay.
I would love to get into spotters specifically for a bit and even talk a little bit about Swarovski models. But first, just going back to ergonomics and just to throw a landmine out there for you to walk on, I would love to hear your thoughts on straight versus angled.
Oh, we sell kind of right down the middle, 50-50, straight versus angled in the spotting scope. And it's changing a bit. It used to be that hunters preferred a straight spotting scope and bird watchers and naturalists preferred an angled spotting scope. But we see now, especially with our highest end spotter, most of what we sell in that spotter is an angled eyepiece. And optically, they're the same, right? There's no optical difference between the two. It becomes personal preference. And what I've found, I'm short in stature. I'm only 5'4", and I hunt with people that are, I don't know how tall you are, Mark, but I know how tall Steve is. And I hunt with people that are Steve's height. So an angled spotting scope is a lot easier for people of different heights to look through without having to move the tripod up and down. Mess around with the height of it. You can also get away with a shorter tripod, and a shorter tripod's always more sturdy or more steady, right? Mm-hmm. The only downside, and there are people who would argue this, but the only downside I've ever found to an angled spotter is that it's a little bit difficult at first to point it at what you want to look at, because you're looking around a corner, right? Mm-hmm. And that goes away pretty quickly. If you use an angled spotter for very long, that kind of goes away and you get it figured out pretty quickly. But that's really the only downside. With a couple of exceptions, hunting coos deer in Arizona, a lot of those guys will switch back and forth from a binocular to a spotting scope on the same tripod and just swap out the optic. And with an angled scope, your scope ends up being too high to look through if it's at the same height as your binoculars were when you took them off the tripod. So that's one of the reasons a lot of those guys in Arizona that hunt coos deer, they like that straight spotter. But it's changing. I don't know the exact number, but I think in our X series or Swarovision spotter, I think we've sold at least twice as many angled eyepieces as we have straight.
Interesting. Yeah. For me, I think you're spot on there. It takes a little while to that target acquisition down, but once you do, you're fiddling with the tripod height a lot less to pan more country.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, and the important thing, too, is it angles, most of them will angle anyway. They don't just angle up. You can release them from the mount and turn them back towards you. So, like, even on a window mount, I like an angled scope because I can angle it back towards myself and sit facing forward in my seat. So,
but I just can't it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's personal preference, and the people that love one hate the other, and people that hate one love the other. So,
can you go ahead and, go into something you cover probably a lot, I'm sure, maybe going into a little bit of your salesman mode, but just to kind of contrast the lines that you have on the spotting scope side of things for Swaro and, you know, decision considerations where one might steer towards one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have two lines of spotting scopes. We have our traditional scope that we've had out for a while. That's our S series spotter. It's available in angled and straight and at a 65 and an 80 millimeter objective. And it's kind of a traditional design with a zoom eyepiece that can be interchanged for other eyepieces. We have made that scope for a really long time and we still make it. And then we have a spotter we released. It's probably 4 years, maybe 5 years ago, that we call our modular spotter or our Swaro Vision spotter. That has some really unique features, to it. The biggest difference between those two is the optical system. The optical system in the Swaro Vision spotter is light years ahead of anything else that's out there. It uses the same technology that we have in our EL binocular, field flattening lenses that completely remove all of the edge distortion and all of the size and shape distortion from the image. So square things are square and straight lines are straight all the way out to the very edge of your field of view. And the whole thing is in focus all the way out to the edge. And that's unique to that Swaro Vision spotter. One of the things that people have seen it advertised is, you know, it kind of comes apart in two pieces in the middle. And that's like the least cool thing about it. That seems to be the one that gets advertised the most. But but it's a modular system where you can pick whatever objective you want and pick whatever eyepiece you want and interchange those and maybe have a couple of different objectives. That one is, I guess the downside to that system is it is a little heavier than the S series spotter. It's optically better, but it is a little bit heavier because it has two big pieces of glass in the eyepiece called field flattening lenses that are heavy, right? So it is a little heavier. But I like to say the juice is worth the squeeze with that spotting scope because even though it's a little heavier, the image quality is so amazing that it's worth carrying a few extra ounces, I think, to get that that better contrast and longer eye relief. It's much more comfortable to use. The ergonomics of it are better. The zoom and the focus are right together on the scope body, so you're not fiddling back with the very end of the spotter, moving the whole thing around to change your zoom. It's more easily camera adaptable than the old spotter. And just all around. But of course, it's quite a bit more expensive as well, right? Yeah. So you're paying a penalty in weight and a penalty in price to step up to that improved optical design.
Yeah, one of the new options on that Swaro Vision series, the X series, is a binocular style eyepiece, and that's new for this year, right?
It is the BTX.
That's pretty cool. When I saw it, I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, it is really cool. What do you think about it, Steve?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I want a lightweight compact version to take backpacking, but like just as like sit there and glass through it is unbelievable. You know, you just don't have to do the whole close your left eye or, you know, it's like binoculars on a tripod on steroids.
Yeah. It's crazy cool. And you know, what's funny is I think we kind of under anticipated, how well it would be received. And so it's pretty tough to get a hold of. We're in the enviable position, I guess, that we have more orders than we have the ability to produce BTXs at the current time. So it's a little tough to get, but it's a really cool piece. It takes away all those all the bad things about a spotting scope, like scope eye. Sitting behind a spotting scope with one eye closed, or even eye patch over your eye. I've seen that done. It wears that one eye out pretty quickly, and you can't really stay in that spotting scope for hours on end. But with this BTX, we call it a biocular eyepiece. It's not really true binocular vision, but your brain kind of accepts it as such, but you can stay in that thing for hours on end and just live in that image. It's so comfortable to use and so easy on your eyes that it's a whole different experience. It is like what Steve said. It's like having a giant binocular on a tripod on steroids. And it's on the 95 millimeter objective, our biggest objective, it's a fixed 35 power. And on the smaller objectives, it's a fixed 30 power, but big wide field of view and really easy to use and really a cool optic. The target market for that is kind of like the guys that are using the big eyes. You know, Koa makes the Koa Highlander, a really nice set of great big, it's essentially two spotting scopes side by side. And those are used a lot in kind of mountain hunting, especially a lot of guides use those. The problem is they're heavy, and I'm not sure how much they weigh. I think it's 12 pounds, but D wants a lightweight version of our BTX, and we're like, wow, it only weighs 6 pounds.
Yeah. You know?
And it's interesting, you know, I've been parading that thing around for the last couple months and showing everybody, and everybody just thinks it's the coolest thing ever. And I went to, speaking about the weight, I went up to Northern British Columbia a few weeks ago for an event up there, and was so excited to show it off, and everybody that looked at it said, man, that thing looks heavy. You know,
yeah.
So it is a little heavy. It's about, it's just over 6 pounds with the 95 objective, and it's just under 5 pounds with the 65 objective on it. So it is heavy. I'm not sure, 100% sure how I'm going to use it. I think what it's going to do is replace my 15 power binoculars, and I'll use it kind of as a half binocular, half spotting scope in the way I hunt. But it's really, really a cool piece, and we're excited to get more of them out there and let people play with them.
Steve, what else do you have? We'll have Kobe. I mean, I feel like we could go another 2 hours. I can't believe it's been an hour already,
sure.
But anything else we need to cover?
I think, Kobe, I'm sure you've seen just horrendous examples of this. What's the best way not to clean and to clean your optics?
That's a great question. In fact, I was hoping we'd bring that up, because that's one thing we see two extremes, right? We see people that are afraid to touch their optics for fear they're going to scratch them, so they never clean them, right?
Which is me most of the time.
Yeah. Then we see people that over clean them and end up grinding all kinds of crud into their lenses and reducing the effectiveness of their very high end and very fancy binoculars. So, most, and I think all, decent optics are waterproof, and they're not even designed to be waterproof from the get go. They're sealed on the inside to keep them from fogging up on the inside and purged with some kind of a inert gas, nitrogen or argon or whatever. But that makes them waterproof on the outside. So what we recommend is running them under, especially if they're really dirty, running them under the faucet and letting running water or dunking them in the stream, but letting running water wash away the dust and the grit and the dirt that's on the lenses. And then once that's gone, you can use a good microfiber lens cloth to kind of polish off the water spots that might remain. We have a cleaning kit. There's all kinds of cleaning kits out there. Don't recommend using Windex or anything that's made for cleaning windows, but, you know, some guys use denatured alcohol. Some guys most of the cleaning kits have some kind of a solution in them, and that's great for getting those water spots off. But the very, very first thing, that you should do is get the grime and dirt off of there before you start rubbing on that lens with anything. The worst thing you can do is grab your t-shirt, and I do it. I'm as guilty as anybody else, but grab your t-shirt and wipe it off, because you're just grinding that grime right into the surface of that lens and just creating sandpaper, you know?
Yeah. What do you think about those? The one I've gravitated towards in the past is just those lens pins with like a brush on one end and then kind of a microfiber. I just try to brush off as much dust as I can and then go back and put light pressure on with that kind of microfiber pin side to it. I don't know what you call that. Yeah.
Yep. If you're going to use one of those, that's the way to use it. Exactly. The brush is great. Just like, you know, to get all the stuff off the microfiber end of it. If you keep that clean and you keep from getting grit embedded into that little microfiber pad on there, then it's great. It does a good job of kind of polishing up that lens. The downside is if you get dirt and grime in that little microfiber end, then you're just grinding it into your yeah. Exactly. So, you know, a good most optics come with some kind of a microfiber cloth of some sort, and that's what I use. And I just keep that clean, throw it in the washing machine with my hunting clothes when I get home, and use that. And your tongue actually is a pretty good way to get all the junk off there. I've seen that a lot.
Just lick it, baby.
I'm not saying everybody should go around licking their binoculars, but some people's tongues are probably cleaner than others. Maybe so, but in the field, if you don't have running water to kind of wash that stuff away, or a brush to brush it away, your tongue actually just does a pretty good job. So
that's
use that with caution. Use that tip with caution.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever thought of it, but yeah, I'll give that a shot in a pinch.
Lick the eyepieces and then hand it to your buddy.
That's right. And then, you know, you see a lot of folks will have those spuds, spuds cloths on their hanging on their bino harness. Those are great. They're handy. They're there. It's a good quality lens cloth. Just keep it clean. You know, throw it in the washing machine. Every once in a while, get the stuff out.
Okay, cool.
Colby, man, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I mean, I know that I've soaked up some solid info. I know that our listeners are absolutely going to love this one. Anywhere that you would like to point our listeners to learn more about Swarovski, stay in touch with you, anything that you want to share with the audience?
Well, you know, we have our website that shows all of our products. There's actually some really good technical information on there. There's specs. There's actually some interactive kind of learning modules on there. You can, if you want to get down in the weeds, you can get down in the weeds. But, you know, I'm on Instagram, as most of my coworkers are. We're pretty easy to get a hold of. And you know, we're out at all the shows, all of the events. We do this because we love to do it, and we're always willing to help. And don't mind answering questions about our stuff or anybody else's stuff.
All right, final question, then we'll let you go.
Yeah.
What's the one hunt you're looking forward to most this coming year?
Oh, that's a great question. I've got a couple of them. I didn't draw anything in Utah at all, not even a cow tag. My own state doesn't like me, but I'll pick up an archery elk tag probably in Utah. But I've got a mule deer and pronghorn hunt in Wyoming that I'm looking forward to at the end of September. That'll be a lot of fun. But I also am going to Southeast Alaska to hunt Sitka blacktail.
Oh, awesome!
The end of October, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to that. I've never hunted Alaska. I've never hunted Sitka blacktail, so it should be a good time. Vessel based, you know, staying on the boat and going ashore trying to find some deer. So we'll be on Admiralty Island, which I guess has the highest density of brown bears of anywhere on the planet. So I'm pretty excited about that. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that one a lot. It'll be a good time. Yeah, completely different from what I usually do. And I like that. I like to get out and do different stuff and see different countries. So I'm excited about that.
Awesome. Well, Colby, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you bet. Take care.
Well, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. As always, we would love to hear your feedback or questions or comments. You can email us directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com. If you're enjoying the show, we would love to see a review from you in iTunes or wherever else you might be listening to this. Until next time, happy hunting. Hope you can get outside. If your season's over, make sure you go out and explore, take some kind of adventure, get some fresh air. Enough of the computers, enough of the podcast, all that. Get outside and enjoy it.